This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 42 million people in the United States have student debt, and the price tag on that debt currently comes in at about $1.3 trillion. That's according to a new report from Reveal, a public radio program in conjunction with the Center for Investigative Reporting. The numbers vary on a state-by-state basis, but here in North Carolina in 2014, 61% of students graduating from public and private four-year institutions left with loans. Many are calling this a student debt crisis. The new report, Who Got Rich Off the Student Debt Crisis?, looks at the convergence of trends and decisions that got us to this point, including the privatization of Sallie Mae and the continued divestiture in public higher education at the state level. Joining me now to talk about one of the reports is one of the report's co-authors, Lance Williams. He's a senior reporter at Reveal. Lance, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Let's recap where we are now. Is this a student debt crisis? Why are we calling it a crisis? What are the figures and the indicators that suggest to you that this is, in fact, a crisis?
Well, if you're in the middle of it, it's certainly a crisis. But as you said, 42 million Americans have student debt. The debt levels in some cases are really high. And for young people who are now going into middle age, it distorts the entire trajectory of their lives because they, once in, have trouble getting out.
But it does. But it's easy. Like if you have the number of, if I give you the number of Americans who have a mortgage, that's debt, and there'd be a lot of people, but they can all kind of pay it back. We kind of get that. So the question for me is, what has changed? Because student debt is not a new thing. Maybe the number of people with debt, but it seems to me the centerpiece of the reporting is the inability to pay it back, owing to these added burdens that have changed because of policy decisions over time that have really made this burden a very difficult thing to pay back.
Sure. Well, the mortgage analogy breaks down a little bit because you're paying on an asset, a house, and if you don't make the payments, they can seize the asset and you walk away. Your student loan you can't walk away from no matter what happens. Unfortunately, in your life, if your job prospects don't work out, if you get ill, whatever, that loan stays with you and the interest and penalties compound. You can't get out from a student loan under bankruptcy, for example. It's one of the few kinds of debts in America that you cannot discharge in that way. And so we're seeing now in our second generation of heavy borrowing, you know, we're seeing people actually having their Social Security garnisheed by the government for failure to pay for student loans that they racked up when they were young people.
Give us some context, too, to how we got to this point. You talk about this has to do in large part with the privatization of Sallie Mae. So we should tell us just briefly what Sallie Mae is, but how when privatization happened and how that's contributed to this crisis.
Sure. You know, the history of the student loan program was it goes back to the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson. Johnson was a nut for education, as his vice president said, and wanted a student loan program to facilitate college for people who otherwise couldn't consider it. And that's the way the program worked, and Sallie Mae was initially created as a government-related entity whose job was to create a market for student loans that the feds were underwriting. In the 90s, it became privatized. The student loan industry grew up through some decisions by the Congress in the old days of Contract for America, the Newt Gingrich speakership. And away we went. What's grown up is a private industry whose priority is to make money for shareholders. That's what private industry does. And the goal of facilitating college education for people has maybe taken a back seat.
But there anyway, there have to be. And what's interesting about this is that the privatization alone wouldn't have done it. But then the rule changes, as you say, a rule change that allowed, that prohibited student debt from being considered under bankruptcy. So talk a little bit about this, because, again, if I'm on Wall Street and if I'm in a bank, I don't want to make loans to people who can't pay them back. That's a bad business deal. Unless I can write rules that can keep them under my thumb and make special rules. All that had to happen together in many ways, like the subprime scandal in 2008, making loans that people can't pay back strikes me as a bad business model, right?
Right. But in the case of private student loans, the lender already can underwrite those loans, as we say. You don't have to, unlike the feds, a private lender does not have to make a student loan to somebody with poor credit, or they can insulate themselves against risk by jacking the rate up. But then you lay on top of that a measure that passed Congress in the 90s that said that you can't, even if you go bust, you can't use bankruptcy to discharge your private student loan. You're building in an absolute guarantee for the lender that they're going to get paid. You know, there's no way that person borrowing the money is not going to be on the hook for it for life.
All right, so we call this the fact that the government's underwriting the loan and now prohibits you from getting out from under it through bankruptcy. This would be considered a moral hazard, right? This means, let's go make these loans because we'll always make our money, which is not how you want the business sector to work. You really want them to bear some of the risk and then charge accordingly. So this is a kind of a broken mechanism from the get-go once we get into the 90s. So but what about that? I mean, then it's up to students to say, wait a minute now, let's take a look at this. Shouldn't I have my eyes open and say, maybe I better not get into this deal. It doesn't look like a good one.
Well, today, the level of information and advice for young people considering college and how to pay for it is a lot better. But for most of the life of the student loan program, the info available to teenagers who had never even bought a car, let alone borrowed tens of thousands of dollars, was pretty poor. We've got a gentleman, Ashley Dale, here, who can tell you about the kind of bad advice he got at NC State when he was taking out really a modest amount of federal loans for his education. People aren't informed, and kids make poor choices is the other thing. And it would be terribly burdensome to wake up in middle age and still be dealing with a bad choice you made at 17 or 18, but that's the reality for thousands of people who have signed up for loans.
And the other thing about this so-called bad choice is there's not much choice when it comes to your future about going to college. So if you're at some income level that you can't choose, the choice not to go to college is not a good one either. So again, it's a different kind of bad choice. Let's talk about also the cost going up, because that's another part of this debt crisis. State governments now continue to divest in public education. They're per capita spending less and less every year, although nominally the numbers go up. Tell us about that, the impact that's had.
Well, it is a convergence of factors here that brings us to the state we're in. Yeah. I think state support for public higher ed peaked in the 70s, and it's been rolled back year after year since then. We calculated that if the states had continued to support public higher ed at the rate they did in 1980, they would have invested an additional $500 billion in public university systems in the U.S. It's a billion with a B. And that's an amount that's roughly equal to the outstanding student debt now held by people who went to public colleges and universities. So there's a little symmetry there. That's a big chunk of money not available to universities, and the students have made up the difference by and large by borrowing. It's a different world than it was in 1980. State legislators have different priorities and different responsibilities. There are things you have to pay for that you legally must pay for as a state lawmaker. They didn't have to a generation ago, but it is true that we've geared way back and loans have made up the difference by and large.
Well, you made reference to Ashley Dale. He is sitting here before me, a 51-year-old Raleigh-based software operator. He's featured in the new student loan debt report because of his experience with a student loan, which now has a balance of around $78,000. Ashley Dale, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So tell us how you got where you are today. You first took out loans in 1992?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about that.
I, at the time, was working for a printing company. It was right at the time that computers were being introduced. After teaching several very large companies how to transition from flat art to computer art, I thought, this is going to be a really interesting field. So I decided to switch over to graphic design and get out of the printing industry, which was a great decision.
Mm-hmm.
But that involved having to take out the student loans. And since then, the graphic design field has been completely saturated.
Right.
Anybody that has a computer now can buy Photoshop. They can buy InDesign. They can they can make whatever anybody asks of them to make. So the market got saturated, and bottom line, it was really difficult to get a job.
You took out $16,000 in loan?
Yes, sir.
$16,000.
About $16,000.
So how does that cut to $78,000?
One of the things I think people don't understand about the student loan and the way that it's structured is that every year you don't pay the interest on it. The following year, that interest gets rolled into the principal. So every year your principal is growing and growing, and then you're paying interest on interest on interest on interest, and it's impossible to get out from under.
And did you say by the time you got out, there was no market for your skills?
Correct. It took me about 6 months to get a job, and then I was making $24,000 a year.
So what's happening now? What's going on with you now at this moment? Are you making payments, and where does that stand? Because there are other penalties too, right? If you don't pay after a certain amount of, tell us more about what happens if you go for a certain length of time, apart from the fact that the interest then becomes principal. There are other penalties as well.
Well, it's really interesting. The government will get you on a payment plan to get you out of default. Those payments can range from $100 a month to, I've paid like $250 a month to go from being in default to getting out of default. Once you get out of default, then the government contacts you and says, great, now you're out of default. So now here's this huge amount of money we need to pay. We need you to pay us every month.
So you're off that little payment plan that just kind of is showing
exactly
due diligence. But now you're into the original number, which is the one you couldn't pay in the first place.
Exactly.
That's why you went into default.
And that's one of the things that I think is misunderstood as well, is that the majority of people, they want to pay the money back that they borrowed. I don't want to discharge it in bankruptcy. I want to pay for what I borrowed because I borrowed it. But that opportunity has not been given to me at any point in the last 22 years to actually start paying on that principal. If I could, I've asked them, hey, stop charging me interest. The government said, that's not what we do, because they know they don't have to, that they can still get that interest out of me one way or another.
Lance, we're talking about the government here. Ashley's talking about the government. You're receiving this from the Department of Education or IRS?
Yes, sir.
Both. Are they working for the – I mean, who's actually getting the dough here, because we've privatized this? So these are investors that are getting the interest that the government is acting as the debt collector. Am I right about that, or is there some part of this I'm missing?
In Ashley's case, the private industry component would probably be the collection guys. Those are government contractors. But the federal loans themselves, ultimately, they've been issued by private companies, but the government backs them, and government ultimately is paid on them. And government makes a lot of money off student loans. It's not just private industry. There's a GAO report that says that just on loans issued between 2007 and 2012, those are projected to generate $66 billion in income for the federal government by the time they're all repaid. So it's a not insignificant chunk of change for the federal treasury, and it's one thing that makes reform efforts for people who've already borrowed, people like Ashley, makes it so problematic in the Congress, because it's going to come right out of the general fund.
Right. And if you're proposing legislation, then the idea is you will either have to raise taxes, oh no, or cut even further public services. And so rather than do that, you say, well, let's just keep this program going. Ashley, talk about the amount of information you had. Lance talked about a sort of a dearth of information. How much of what you described to me that's happening to you were you aware of when you took out the loan?
Zero. I did have a conversation with the financial aid department about what my payment was going to look like. And I specifically asked over this program length, what am I looking at as a payment? And the estimate was between $80 and $100 a month. And that was very doable. The first bill I finally got was around $340, which at the time, as the article says, at the time my apartment rent was $275 a month and my car payment was $109. So $340 was a huge amount of money that I just, at that point in time, I couldn't pay.
Lance, how typical is Ashley's story?
Well, most people don't get in as bad a trouble as Ashley, but there are thousands upon thousands of people who are in much worse trouble. It really depends on how, you know, your career prospects work and how your life goes as to whether you wind up paying for 10 or 12 years and pay your loans off and go on with your life, or whether you fall into one of these situations. There are now, for people borrowing, there are payment plan options and other ways to reduce or discharge your federal debt that weren't available for him and aren't available for most of the many millions of people who already have the loans.
This obviously falls disproportionately on people with families with lower incomes, but more and more, I guess, where it's given the rise in tuition generally, and particularly in state institutions. I would guess that more and more people in the middle and upper middle ranges are actually feeling this, aren't they, Lance?
That's true, but the people who get hammered the hardest are lower income people who go to for-profit colleges, trade schools, and so forth. That's where the private loans are most liberally distributed, and it's where dissatisfaction with the educational program is often rife, and you have people who are trying to better themselves by learning a job skill walking away from the program after a couple of months because it's obviously worthless, and they take with them tens of thousands of dollars of debt, and they don't have any prospects of getting that hot new job to pay it off.
Ashley, tell us about your situation now. I mean, given the debt that you have, given your salary, I mean, where are you now? What are your prospects of ever paying off that loan?
Unless the government's willing to work with me, it'll never get paid off. I pay them $50 a month now. They take my federal tax return every year, and that amounts to about $1,500 a year. And that's, I've paid, of the original $16,000, I've paid back about half of that, and now you've seen what the balance is.
What does it do to your credit rating and your ability to borrow elsewhere?
It makes the interest rate a lot higher. Yeah. I finally had to get a new car, and my interest rate was quite a bit larger than what most people could get. But my income to debt ratio because of this loan, even though it's been paid on every month, is a lot higher than it would be had I been able to pay this off.
Well, Lance, that brings us to wealth building. Again, if you're in the lower income ranges, the idea of building wealth and getting yourself out of that range or your children becomes less and less possible with this debt burden, it would seem to me.
Yeah, and in the for-profit institution realm, it's particularly tragic because the recruiting of prospective students is always based on, you know, let's pull yourself up and do something for your family. And, you know, there are some dissatisfied customers that none of that has happened for.
Any prospect on cracking down on those, particularly the for-profit institutions, and making sure they're delivering on their promises and managing these loans the way they should be?
Well, things are much tougher for them now than they were 10 years ago. I mean, there's general awareness of the sort of downside of student debt and of some of these education innovations that live off it. What's so intractable is the problem of what do we do about all the people who already got the loans and don't have the benefit of the education. What are we going to do to help them? And it's expensive.
Lance Williams, senior reporter for Reveal, a radio show and podcast in conjunction with the Center for Investigative Reporting, who co-authored a new report called Who Got Rich Off the Student Debt Crisis. Lance, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ashley Dale is with us as well, a 51-year-old software operator from Raleigh who's living with $78,000 in student debt. Ashley, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate it.
You can find links to the report at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, two teachers who are arrested to get better pay and better funding for education. Stay tuned.